And this is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Spanning more than 200 years, the African American and Latinx history of the United States are revolutionary. They are politically charged narratives arguing that the global South was crucial to the development of America as we know it. They challenge the notion of westward progression as exalted by widely taught formulations such as manifest destiny and Jacksonian democracy, and show how placing African American Latinx unapologetically front and center transforms American history into this story of the working class organizing against imperialism. Re-envisioning American history, an intersectional history of the shared struggle for African-American Latinx people's civil rights.
With Paul Ortiz, professor of history and director of the oral history program at the University of Florida. He is the author of Emancipation Betrayed, The Hidden History of Black Organizing and White Violence from Reconstruction to the Bloody Elections of 1920, and An African-American and Latinx History of the United States.
Now, an epic, panoramic account of class struggles in the Western Hemisphere at center stage of the Black, Latinx, and Indigenous people who built the New World.
I'd go up to campus, you know, and maybe I was involved in student labor issues, so I'd know that maybe AFSCME or Q or UPTI or AFT, they might be having a contract battle, and there'd be a picket line at the campus, you know, 6 a.m. Paul Ortiz is there. He knows everyone on the line and is bringing spirit and warmth and solidarity. He's this tireless organizer and intellectual that has brought so much to the universities he's been a part of, including the UC. He's now at University of Florida as a history professor and also head of a very important oral history center, Sam Rapachter Oral History Center there.
Give a warm welcome to Paul Ortiz.
Thank you, Sean.
Well, it is so great to be here with you, brothers and sisters. It is so exciting. And I wanted to talk about some of the reasons I wrote this book, how the book reads, and read two or three passages from the book to tell you where I'm coming from and what I'm trying to accomplish. This morning, I was at San Jose City College, and I have a couple former students there who are carrying out, this is confidential, an ethnic studies revolution, as they call it. And we had about 50 students in the room, and we were talking history. And these are primarily first-generation college students. And I asked them, I said, does the current historical framework that you read, that you learn in U.S. history, work? Does it make sense to you? Does it seem honest? Does it seem objective? A term, I think, isolationism. Mm-hmm. And when I throw out that term in my history classes at the University of Florida, and half of the students are from the Cuban diaspora, and I throw out the term isolationism, you know how they respond? Thank you. They laugh. It's funny to them to read U.S. historians talking about isolationism as being a major theme in U.S. history, because their entire lives, their grandparents' lives, their great-great-great-grandparents' lives were defined by U.S. intervention from the Monroe Doctrine on. You'll see as you go through the book, I'm trying to reclaim the concept of what the working class is. It isn't just white people. I'm so appalled when I hear someone, or read someone from the New York Times or the Washington Post, start talking about working class people as if it's only talking about white individuals. When I use the term working class in the book, what I say is that for all of our history, African American and Latinx peoples have been working class peoples. And we have a certain relationship to capitalism. We have a certain relationship to the ruling class of this country. We had a certain relationship to plantation owners. We had a certain relationship to the owners of factories in the early 20th century. But we're essentially a working class people. And the great ideas that animate the history of social movements in this country come out of the working classes in every single instance that I've been able to discover. Whether you're talking about the Chicano blowouts, the Chicano movement. I mean, I learned this as a younger United Farm Worker organizer. I'm not old enough to participate in the grape boycott, but I was active in the Chateau Saint Michel boycott. We learned firsthand what side the police are on. You know, we learned firsthand about democracy really quickly. I remember one of the times I was arrested. In fact, I was arrested with my wife. We weren't married then. But after we were arrested in a jail together, we decided, hey, we can get married. You know, we can do this. But I was only kind of reliving what our peoples have been doing for generations, whether we're black, brown, progressive whites, Asian Americans. I mean, we learn through the struggle. We often talk about outcomes, like what are you trying to do? Like a lot of us are involved in the Fight for 15 movement, right? A lot of us are involved in campus organizing, struggles for ethnic studies, labor movements. And we think about how we can wage a successful organizing campaign. In Florida, we just concluded a statewide campaign to put on the ballot in the fall a referendum that will allow a new system to restore the rights of people who have been convicted of a felony in Florida. Because right now we have almost 2 million individuals disenfranchised in Florida because they have been convicted of a felony. But what makes Florida such a reactionary place and makes it ground zero for Donald Trump, in part, is felony disenfranchisement, is this epic taking of power and democracy away from millions of working class people. Mm-hmm. It's the continuation of a Jim Crow, Juan Crow system. When you pick up a history book about U.S. history, it should move you to tears. You should weep. You should cry for joy. You should be happy. Mm-hmm. You should be astonished, because this country has an astonishing history. Peter Wood is an amazing historian of slavery, and he taught us in grad school, don't use the term slave plantations. Let's call them out for what they really were. This is the foremost historian of slavery in the Lowcountry. He says there's slave labor camps. Let's get it right. Slave labor camps. The term plantation, what does it evoke, right? These are places where people died early. In many of these places, infant mortality was as high as 95% in rice, in sugar production in southern Louisiana. Life expectancies were appallingly low. These are not places that people are just farmers. But Peter said something very interesting to a group of my undergraduates. I remember he came to speak at my African diaspora seminar, and I was just kind of watching now. I wasn't really participating. I was watching my students interact with one of my former professors, and they were laughing, they were crying. You know, this is about slavery. You should be crying. You know, you should be, you know, astonished. And at a certain point, one of my students kind of stopped the discussion, and she said, we've been having this really, you know, engaged discussion with you about history. It's caused people to question the fundamental premises of this country. Why can't history be like that when we're in high school? Why can't it be thrilling? Why can't it speak to the problems of today? Why can't U.S. history explain to us why we elected Donald Trump to the White House? They didn't say that part because he hadn't been elected yet. I was just seeing if you were paying attention. Okay. But no, everything but that last part. But essentially, they were asking him, they said, you know, Peter, why, you know, history should be exciting. Why do you make it so boring in high school and even in college sometimes? He said, well, you know, that's a really good question. And I'm going to give you the answer as far as I know. He said, if we taught you U.S. history as it really was, you might ask us questions we couldn't answer as adults. And that would cause us a lot of discomfort. because we want to have the answers. And we don't want you questioning the fundamental premises of the society. Our students come to us, you know, their sophomore, junior, senior years, and they'll say, why didn't we learn about the rise of the farm worker movement in the 60s in high school? Or why didn't we learn about the student strikes at San Francisco State? Or why didn't we learn about the labor movement of the 1930s? And our response is often, my response is often, well, if you went to public school and your public school is teaching you how to create a revolution, I would be really surprised. That would be great. But I'd say, you know, the state should know better than that to allow that to happen. That's why these spaces, these insurgent spaces, are so very important. That's why at Santa Cruz, and Armin and Sean know this, E-Squared was an initiative, an undergraduate initiative to create ethnic studies, which pushed the faculty, and we need you to push the faculty, because you got to keep reminding us, like, why we're here, okay? And we need to have a curriculum where we can learn about our ancestors. We need to have a curriculum that shows us how we, people like us, without any power whatsoever, changed this country, or tried to change it, and what the unresolved problems are of the society. So I just wanted to give you a sense of where a lot of the book comes out of my experiences as a classroom teacher, a labor organizer, but as someone who grew up in that working class environment where no one told us about college. Now I want to take you through a few of the chapters of the book and read a couple of passages. Chapter one is designed to get us to thinking about the beginning of this country's official history. The idea was, this is a book from the American Revolution to the present. It's designed to where you can take out chapters like Reconstruction, the Civil War, waging the struggle against the government of American banks, this incredible anti-imperial struggle in the early 20th century, to tell us why our country continues to have these misfires. So let me start with Haiti and Mexico. The two nations which many of our government leaders constantly attack viciously. And when you think about that, you wonder why. Why Haiti and Mexico? Mexico and Haiti. It's almost, it's like a drumbeat in American history. But Donald Trump is only the latest perpetrator. If you sat Donald Trump down with, I've often thought of this, this is kind of scary. If you sat Donald Trump down with John Quincy Adams, and it was 1816 at the onset of the First Seminole War, and you added in Jefferson, Hamilton, John Adams Sr., Quincy Adams' father, they would have a lot to talk about. What they would, and they would have a lot to disagree with each other, but they would absolutely agree on the need to quarantine and vilify Haiti and Mexico. Because that's what they were doing in 1810. That's what they're doing now. So if there's such a continuity among the ruling class, one has to wonder, why is there that continuity? So my first two chapters, the first chapter is titled The Haitian Revolution and the Birth of Emancipatory Internationalism. And here I'm basically building on a lot of existing scholarship. Some of the work here is looking, I'm a social historian, I love to read old newspapers, as my students can tell you. I'm kind of an old microfilm geek. That's why I wear glasses now. And so, but a lot of the book is based on existing scholarship. Again, people like Carlos Munoz, Cedric Robinson, C.L.R. James, W.E.B. Du Bois. And what we've learned collectively in comparative ethnic studies is that the Haitian Revolution is probably the single most important, well, it is the single most important revolution in the Americas. And it trumps the American Revolution because, of course, it's a successful revolution against slavery, and it establishes the first independent republic in the Americas. And it becomes quickly a beacon of liberty and freedom for oppressed people everywhere. But it's consistently left out of the narrative. In fact, Carlos, the only advantage of having a flight 5 hours behind when I flew out from Miami to here was that I got to watch this great new movie on Simón Bolívar. It was really exciting. You know, it was a Spanish language film. And it talked about his transformation from being a slave owner to being the great liberator. I mean, I remember when I was in Central America in Special Forces seeing, you know, statues of him everywhere. Well, how did he go from being a slave owner to a leader of an army composed largely of former slaves, a liberation army, a new model army, to borrow that imagery of revolutionary soldiering. The movie, I was waiting for this, and I could almost predict it. I didn't want it to happen. I was like, maybe they'll get it right this time. And it was a beautiful movie in many ways. I mean, how many movies do we have in Simón Bolívar? First of all, that's pretty cool, right? But it had to explain his radicalization. But it couldn't go where it needed to go. Simón Bolívar was not a military leader. He didn't grow up in a military background. The Spanish still had the finest infantry of the European armies, with the exception probably of the French, kind of the core French regiments. And he was beaten badly over and over again. He actually had to leave the continent. Where does he go? He goes to Jamaica. So there's a sequence in the film where he's writing this remarkable document. It's a manifesto of what the new America should look like. And it's about bringing people together. But it leaves out the most important part of that sojourn, Haiti. He goes to Haiti. He goes to the South. And the Haitians kind of have a grounding with him, the way Walter Rodney would talk about grounding, right? And they said, you know, we love your struggle and everything. And as far as we know, he met with Henri Christophe and other leaders. And they said, but you're missing a lot of things here. Here's how you can win against the Europeans. And the Haitians have such cachet because they've done it, right? They defeated the Spanish. They defeated the British. They defeated the largest seaborne invasion in human history up to that point. They defeated the French not once but twice. So they have the cachet to give you advice. If the Haitians give you military advice in the early 19th century in the War of Liberation, you take it. And this is why the U.S. and the European powers, so often at odds with each other, are united in the need to put a cordon around Haiti. Okay, so they tell him, the Haitian leaders tell him, love you, Simón, but you've got to abolish slavery. You got to make a unilateral abolition of slavery. Not just people that fight for you, you have to declare abolition. Otherwise, you're not going to win. And that's the decisive factor. When Bolívar goes back to fight the Spanish, it's a new kind of army now. And there's Haitians in that army, by the way. I would, from my special forces background, I call them military advisors. They're teaching them how to defeat people using muskets and precision artillery. The Spanish, again, had some of the best artillerymen of the time, the great engineers. And so Haiti plays that centerpiece role in the liberation of people in Central America. And I'm the faculty advisor of a lot of different, in Florida they use the term Hispanic. Okay, so I'm the faculty advisor of a lot of Hispanic groups, and as Moises knows. So I'm the faculty advisor of the Venezuelan Student Association. And a lot of my colleagues say, Ortiz, I didn't know you were Venezuelan. I'm like, no, I'm not. But I love the country. And I asked my Venezuelan Student Association members, where was your national flag raised first, initially? And they think, oh, it's a professor asking another pop quiz question. Dang it. And I said, well, here's the beautiful thing about your national flag. It was raised initially not in Venezuela or not in anywhere in Central America. It was raised with great pride in Jacmel Bay in Haiti. And the reason it was raised there was that the Haitians continued to provide sanctuary to freedom fighters all the way up to José Martí, Antonio Maceo, and so many others. And this is why Haiti becomes public enemy number one. And this is why to this day, U.S. presidents and leaders are programmed to diss Haiti, to diss Mexico. But why Mexico? So chapter two is the Mexican War of Independence in U.S. history. Anti-imperialism as a way of life. And what I'm working on there, again, based on the scholarship that's out there, William Appleman Williams, who taught us with the tragedy of American diplomacy that the history of America, he was the one who pens the term, initially in an article in The Nation and then in a book, imperialism as a way of American life. In this chapter, I'm trying to get at struggles from below where people make anti-imperialism a way of life, and they begin to connect struggles in Mexico, the United States, Central America, this term racial capitalism. That's a very important concept. People understand by the early 19th century that slavery is an international system. It's not just a system of one country. It's international. And it grows through imperialism. It grows through military actions, aggressive military actions. So aggressive that the U.S. is sending troops and people into Central America as late as the 1850s to try to reimpose slavery in Central America. So much so that the U.S. is going to Cuba in the 1850s before the U.S. Civil War and trying to buy up and take control of Cuba. Slavery grows or it dies. And so this is why radical abolitionists understood that slavery was an imperial system. When the Mexican War of Independence was first launched, it becomes really quickly a war against slavery and indigenous caste oppression. And even before the Mexican people gain their independence, enslaved African Americans are finding sanctuary from slavery in Mexico. When I asked the students earlier today, and I said, I'm going to use the term Underground Railroad, what country comes to mind? What country do you think they said? Canada, because that's all we were taught when I was in high school, Canada, the Underground Railroad. But I asked them from a point of logic, if you're a slave in Louisiana, how do you make it to Canada? Now, there were many cases of people that make that journey because, I mean, the genius of the Underground Railroad. But isn't Mexico closer? And most importantly, Mexico is a nation which is defining itself from the very beginning against what the U.S. did not do. And so in the chapter, I talk about Jose Morelos reaching out to James Madison and saying, President Madison, we're fighting an anti-colonial struggle, kind of like y'all fought not too long ago. We could form a hemispheric-wide front against the aberracious European imperialists. I love the 19th century language, the aberracious, you know. And it was just so astonishing to be able to like translate these documents and try to think about what was going through Jose Morelos's mind, this astonishing former priest turned revolutionary general, trying to persuade a slave owner that he should abolish slavery. What was going through his mind? So this is a point in which U.S. history could have turned. When Mexico abolishes slavery, very soon after that, the U.S. begins trying to sue Mexico. What are they suing Mexico for? They're suing Mexico for the loss of slave property. This is where the U.S. militarizes, mobilizes against Mexico, is mobilized against Haiti, is constantly interfering, and interfering is a euphemism, with Mexico. I found this out not too long ago. I mentioned my family's involvement in the Mexican Revolution, but they also left the same week that the U.S. Marines occupied Tampico. Because again, it's about occupation, Haiti, continues to be the key of liberty.
It will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, one day when the war is won, we will be sure, we will be sure. Oh, glory, glory, glory. Oh,
the heavens, no man, no weapon formed against, yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtaposition in us. Justice for all just ain't specific enough. One son died, a spirit is revisiting us. True and living, living in us. Resistance is us. That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walk through Ferguson with our hands up. When it go down, we woman and man up. They say stay down, and we stand up. Shots we on the ground, the camera panned up. King pointed to the mountaintop, and we ran up.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, one day.
Common and John Legend.
Glory. When the war is won,
it will be ours. The glory will be ours. You are listening to Paul Ortiz, professor of history and director of the Oral History Program at the University of Florida. He is the author of Emancipation Betrayed, The Hidden History of Black Organizing and White Violence from Reconstruction to the Bloody Election of 1920, and an African American and Latinx History of the United States. And we wanted to give you an introduction to Paul Ortiz, who is re-envisioning American history, an intersectional history of the shared struggle for African American, Latinx, and indigenous peoples' civil rights. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.